Marco, you're listening to Astro Talk for the show of Thursday, December 17. I'm watching my favorite astrophysicist now. His name is Brian Cox. He's on TV. He's talking about the New Horizons mission that was launched several years ago that I believe went by Pluto about 2015. And an interesting thing about the New Horizons mission was that the spacecraft hibernated most of the way to Pluto. So there was a concern that what if the spacecraft, we try to wake it up and it won't wake up? But it woke up. So that was an interesting way to save the, or extend the life of the equipment on the spacecraft. But now I'm watching beautiful mountains on Pluto, ice mountains. Pluto, even though it's not a planet anymore, I guess it's called a dwarf planet. It is a world unto itself. It has so many interesting features. It's round. It orbits the sun, but it doesn't clear its orbit, so that's why it's not a planet anymore. And there's quite a few objects out there that are about the same size as Pluto. So, but anyway, Brian Cox now is talking about Pluto and the interesting things they found when they went around Pluto. So what's happening in astronomy? I'm thinking a lot about life, just life in the solar system, life in our galaxy, life in other galaxies. And there was one equation, I believe in 1961, a U.S. astrophysicist, Frank Drake, made a equation called the Drake equation. And I think it's the N is the number of technically advanced civilizations in the Milky Way galaxy. So this is just for the Milky Way. And the equation is R times FP times NE times FL times FT times FT times L. So what are they? R is the mean rate of star formation in the galaxy. F sub P is the fraction of stars with planetary systems. N sub E, the number of planets in any such systems that are ecologically suitable for the origin of life. F sub I, the fraction of such planets on where life in fact develops. Sorry, that's F sub small l. Then F sub small I, the fraction of such planets on which life evolves to an intelligent form. F sub C, the fraction of such worlds in which the intelligent life form invents high technology capable of at least interstellar radio communication. And big L, the last one, the average lifetime of such advanced civilizations. So L is the average lifetime of such advanced civilizations. As you can see on Earth, I talked about it, I believe, last time, was how many ice ages, how many cataclysms our Earth went through, and extinctions followed, and some life forms survived, and when they came out, then they multiplied again. So that's a big thing. Imagine you're close to a star that goes supernova, it could blow you away. So F sub E is the fraction of such worlds in which the intelligent form invents high technology. F sub I, the fraction of such planets on which life evolves to an intelligent form. F sub small l, the fraction of such planets on which life in fact develops. And N sub B, the number of planets in the system that are ecologically suitable for the origin of life. F sub P, the fraction of stars with planetary systems. And star R is the rate, R is the mean rate of star formation in the galaxy. So you can see that a lot of thought went into that equation. And when you look at some of those factors, like ours, the fraction of such worlds in which intelligent life forms invents high technology capable of interstellar radio communication. Well, the dinosaurs couldn't do that, bugs couldn't do that, apes couldn't do that. So there could be worlds out there where there's life, but they're just, compared to human beings, primitive forms of life. But the thing that interested me most, or I think is so important, was the ice ages that we went through, the supervolcanoes that evolved and spewed out their their soot and lava clouded the sky, and the earth became frozen after that, went through ice ages. Dinosaurs were wiped out because of a meteor. So all these things, how life could peek its way through and survive through all those cataclysms, all those extinctions, and how we can factor, if someone were to make a new Drake equation, because this was made in 1961, so that was 59 years ago. No one's come forward. Maybe I should do it. I heard an astronomer once say to an audience member, well, who's going to solve this problem? And the host said, well, maybe you. It's up to somebody out there to invent a new Drake equation, so why not me? So if we look at the Drake equation, seems reasonable, but no one's come up with anything better. Maybe nobody's tried. So that's what gets me about some of these things about astronomy. There's a famous astrophysicist, has written books. He's a professor. He's very, very well respected. I believe his name Michio Kaku or something like that. He's Japanese heritage. Maybe he's from New York. But they were talking about getting weapons to knock out asteroids that are headed for Earth. So he showed this graphic where he says, well, look, let's say this bomb hits this asteroid. It might break apart, but then he showed where after the bomb or the nuclear bomb hit the asteroid, every piece of the asteroid just kept coming towards Earth. And it's not like he said, okay, some of them will vaporize, and that could probably happen because when you have a nuclear reaction, temperatures get very high. So some of it would vaporize. Some of the chunks would go in another direction. It would definitely break apart, but it's not like it would still, every part of the asteroid would keep coming towards Earth. But in his graphic, he showed that, where the bomb hits the asteroid and the asteroid just keeps coming, but in a lot of smaller chunks. So as I said, I think some of these things are easy to challenge, but nobody challenges them. So nobody's challenged the Drake equation. Nobody has brought out another form of the Drake equation. And they've just said, okay, let's look at the Drake equation. So they seem to accept it. And a lot of astronomers are saying, okay, there's multiple universes. There's an infinite number of universes. That's the accepted knowledge. So everybody accepts it. So I'm not sure, for example, in Michio Kaku's graphic where a rocket would hit a meteor, he said, well, that's not the best thing. Look what would happen. The meteor pieces would break apart, but they would just all keep coming to Earth. Well, I don't think so. Some would vaporize, so some would be instantly destroyed. Others would go on a different trajectory. Some would be knocked backwards. Some would be sideways. Some would go off at different angles. So sometimes some of these things are not challenged. And I guess we're just supposed to accept everything that comes to us. Okay, there's an infinite number of universes. So what I think about that is, well, what is space exactly? Is there an infinite amount of space? Does space ever end? In our universe, there's the visible universe, the edge of the visible universe. And there's speculation there could be more beyond what we can see. But does that mean that space is endless? There is no end to space. Space fills up. If there's an infinite number of universes, is there an infinite number of space? Is there an infinite amount of space? So there's a lot of things. For example, I think I would challenge, or I would at least ask questions about. So the Drake equation, he seems to take all these little things, and in his equation, he tries to get the number of technically advanced civilizations in the Milky Way galaxy as a function of other factors. So, as I said, for example, one factor is the fraction of such planets on which life develops. So if some system, for example, has 10 planets, this factor would be F sub I, the fraction of such planets on which life develops. That seems like a sound a sound thing to look at. And then the next one would go F sub I, the fraction of such planets on which life evolves to an intelligent form. So that seems pretty good factor. Next one is the fraction of such worlds in which intelligent life forms advanced technology capable of interstellar communication. So there's lots of little factors on in the Drake equation that seem reasonable, but those three follow each other, it seems like. For example, the fraction that develops life, the fraction that that develops intelligent life, and the next thing is the fraction which develops intelligent life that is capable of communication. So those three are kind of related. So how can you put all three of those in a row? And they almost talk about the same thing, don't they? So if we have life forms that cannot communicate, does that not mean that there's no life in that system? So would, if we give that factor zero, F sub C, the fraction of worlds in which they're capable of communicating, if that's equal to zero, then the whole equation would be equal to zero, because his equation would be N equals R times FP times NE times FL times FI times FC times L. So if any one of those factors are zero, then that means there's no life in that system. But there could be life there. It's just that it cannot communicate. So he multiplies all these things. So if anything is zero, that means there's no life in that system. But I think we can say, well, if there's life there, it doesn't have to communicate for the system to actually have life. So a lot of these things can be challenged. And one thing that gets me is how things are generally accepted by the community at large, the astronomical community. So if someone says to me, there's another universe out there that has someone that looks exactly like you, that's doing the exact same thing that you are. Mathematically, we can say, okay, that's reasonable, because if there's an infinite number of universes, then mathematically I can prove that there would be someone out there that's doing exactly what you're doing, and it looks exactly like you, the same age. Mathematically, we can say yes, but just in an intuitive sense, is there a universe out there with somebody that's got the same clothes as I have on, that's talking into a recorder, that's doing an AstroTalk show? So astronomers, I think in science as well, seem to generally accept the conventional wisdom, and then they say, okay, there's an infinite number of universes. Well, I would say, can you say there's an infinite amount of space? And before the Big Bang, we had a infinitely dense point, which eventually, after the Big Bang, became our universe. So there was really no space there to talk about, but somehow our universe expanded out and filled space. So is there an infinite number of spaces, or is an infinite amount of space? So I think there's a lot of things where I read and I think, well, like the Drake equation, and they say, okay, this is the Drake equation, these are the factors, and everybody looks at it, okay, let's look at the Drake equation, and they don't challenge it. So I think the Drake equation should be challenged. All you astronomers out there, think of a new Drake equation. You might win a Nobel Prize for it. So anyway, I guess this is our mind working, because we're an intelligent civilization, I think, except maybe not for the President of the United States. But anyway, let's move on. There's a meteor shower out there, believe it or not. The Geminid meteor shower peaks Sunday night. So it peaked last night. And of course, we're hampered here in Vancouver because it rains. And I think I saw this commercial or this ad on the bus talking about some kind of liquor. And they said, for that rainy night. And then it said, for all 300 of them. So I don't think we have 300 rainy nights of the year, but sometimes it seems. But we're not blessed with skies that we live in a city as well. So when the earthquakes hit LA and all the power went out a few years ago, all of a sudden the Milky Way came into, I think everybody could basically see the whole streak of the Milky Way. Was beautiful. And I've seen it a few times. So when you live in Arizona or New Mexico, you probably are blessed with beautiful skies most nights, where you can see the great events, the great cosmic events. So there's the meteor shower, and here I have an article. It says how to watch the northern lights across the far northern U.S. So that was 4 days ago. So I don't think we could see the northern lights. But anyway, so I rambled on for a while, and I think I had to, because there's so many things that I hear in astronomy, and it seems like we're told, well, just accept them as fact. So the Drake equation, we seem to look at it, and we go, okay, let's analyze the Drake equation. Why not make a new Drake equation? Is there an infinite number of universes? Well, how could there be an infinite amount of space before the Big Bang, where our universe was just a little speck? Did the space exist there? And then all of a sudden, after the Big Bang, our universe started to expand. So where's the space that we're expanding out to? As I said, is there an infinite amount of space? So here we go. We're going to start talking about real astronomy now. And you don't have to listen to me ramble on anymore. So we're going to talk about the Gemini meteor showers. So their meteor showers peaked last night. And it says here's how to watch the show. So in the photo here, it shows a silo and a barn. And it is Western Iowa, of course, where I guess they're out of a city, not much lights, and it shows the beautiful streaks across the sky. It said meteors lighted the skies over Western Iowa during the Geminid meteor shower. So it's G-E-M-I-D. So the best shooting stars of the year should be visible on Sunday night, December 13th, into the wee hours of Monday morning, December 14th. One of the biggest jips in my life was, I was in Shanghai, I believe in 2009 or 2010, and there was an eclipse, and we went out about 9 in the morning. We were all excited, but it was raining, so we couldn't see anything. Then all of a sudden, for a little while, everything went totally dark. It's like we were in nighttime, and the light came back on, but we weren't able to see the, like the Pac-Man type thing where it gobbles up the dots. We couldn't see the sun gobbling up the moon. So that was a jip. So of course, when you have rainy nights, it's a jip, isn't it? So again, this article is on livescience.com. It's called Spectacular Geminid Meteor Shower Peaks Tonight. Here's how to watch the show. So it's dated December 12th. And there's another article I'm going to read a bit later. It says Gemini Meteor Shower 2020 Peaks Sunday Night, posted by Bruce McClure and Deborah Bird in Astronomy Essentials. So it's dated December 13th. So I'll read the first thing, the first article. And this is called Spectacular Geminid Meteor Shower Peaks Tonight. Here's how to watch the show, by Stephanie Pappas, Live Science contributor, which is dated December 12th. And again, I said there's an image of Western Iowa showing the beautiful streaks. I did see a meteor shower once. I went to SFU and I lied on the trunk of my car, and it was better than Seymour Mountain, which I went up once. Took out my telescope, and it's pitch dark. I'm looking at the Andromeda Galaxy and many beautiful things in the sky. And then something in the bush starts to move towards me. It was making a lot of noise. So I said, I'll put my telescope away and I'll get out of here, which I did. But in SFU, you don't have that problem. So I lied on top of my car, saw a beautiful meteor shower. Okay, so back to the story. So December 13th in the night and Monday morning, December 14th. That's when the Geminids meteor shower is expected to peak. This annual meteor shower gets its name because the bulk of the meteors seem to emanate from near the constellation Gemini. The space rocks come from an object called 3200 Phaeton, Phaeton, which is a rocky asteroid that shed at its travels in an orbit around the Sun. Some of the chunks of rocks shed by 32 Phaeton zip into Earth's atmosphere and burn up, creating a spectacular light show every December. So says Diana Hannah-Kanen, the observing editor at Sky and Telescope, in quote, "It's worth braving the cold during this shower's peak. The Geminids offer the best display of shooting stars all year." So I'm sorry if my voice is kind of raspy and gruff, but I was chewing on a nice thing of peanuts and raisins and everything, and now my voice is gruff, so sorry about that. That's not very intelligent, is it? At least Drake wouldn't think so. The show peaks at around 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Sunday and should continue well past midnight, so that's about 11 p.m. our time. The radiant, or point from which the most meteors will appear to emanate, will be at its peak above the horizon at 2 a.m. Eastern Time on December 14th, making for some of the best viewing. So here's another word I learned. The radiant, the point from which the most meteors will appear to emanate. So here I am back. Guess what I just did? I showed I'm part of intelligent civilization because I was coughing madly. So all I can do is keep coughing, go get some water, come back, start talking. The time that I coughed, I just erased it out of my program. So that shows that maybe I do have some intelligence. The radiant will be above the horizon for most Northern Hemisphere viewers by Sunday 9 p.m., making for great viewing even earlier in the night. Even better, the moon is new on Sunday night, creating darker sky conditions. So let's look at that word again, radiant. The point from which the most meteors will appear to emanate. Wow, that's so cool, the radiant. So says Heineken again, and quote, "If you got a clear, dark sky with no light pollution, you might see a meteor streak across the sky every minute or two from 10 p.m. until dawn in the night of the peak." Yes, it's beautiful to see a nice meteor shower. Sky and Telescope offered these tips for successful meteor show viewing. Find a dark spot away from the city. Go outside early. Allow your eyes to adjust for about 20 minutes to better see fainter meteors. Look towards the darkest part of the sky, which is usually straight up. Meteors can appear anywhere in the sky. Bundle up, and if Sunday night is cloudy, don't give up. Geminids may also be visible the night before and after the peak, with fainter meteors more likely in the night of December 13th, and brighter meteors more likely in the night of December 14th. So while I'm speaking now, it's December 14th, so maybe I can still see something. I don't know. This is an interesting one. Go outside early. Allow your eyes to adjust for about 20 minutes. So I remember that I used to do that. I would put an hour before I'd view. I'd put my telescope out on the porch so everything would cool down to the temperature of the outside air rather than the warmer air that was in the house. The debris you'll see streaking through the sky is said to be pea-sized. These fragments slough off 3200 Phaeton as it nears the sun, which heats its surface to about 1300 degrees Fahrenheit or 700 degrees Celsius. The particles hit Earth's atmosphere at about 79,000 miles per hour, 127,138 kilometers per hour, and vaporized due to the friction of air. So again, this is one thing that I keep talking about. The scales of astronomy, for example, the speed of light, the distances that we talk about, like even one light year is amazingly far away. We never even think on those time scales. We don't travel as fast as things like that. We don't travel distances like that. So astronomy has, like for example, the explosion, what's the energy released when a supernova or when two black holes collide. It's unfathomable, the scales that we talk about when we talk about astronomy. So after the Geminis, the next chance to see meteor showers will be the Ursids in late December, and the Quadrantins from late December 2020 to early January 2021. Okay, so that's a beautiful light show, and I'm going to just quickly go to the other article. Geminid meteor shower 2020 peak Sunday night. This is from earthsky.org, posted by Bruce McClure and Deborah Boyd in Astronomy Essentials, December 13th. See the Geminid meteor shower, always a highlight of the meteor year, Sunday evening until Monday's dawn. The peak times, as seen from around the globe, is centered on 2 a.m. With no moon, the shower expected to be grand this year. It shows a beautiful picture of Glacier Park, Montana. So all these beautiful Midwestern states, and in Canada, like Manitoba, Saskatchewan, where there's clear sky, not rain like here, and when you're away from city, there is beautiful scene. So if anybody saw it, I hope you had a grand time. So this is Marco. I'm going to go for a break now. You are listening to Astro Talk on CITR 101.9.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Salam, روزتون بخیر. My name is Sahan, the president of UBC Persian Club.
And this is Yasaman, the VP admin.
UBC Persian Club is a non-profit student organization with the goal of empowering the Iranian community at UBC by acting as a social hub for Iranian students, bringing together diverse members of the community who have a common interest in Iranian culture, and nurturing and representing the Iranian community in Vancouver.
We have monthly member exclusive events, Pelon, the screen documentary movies and short films by Iranian directors with English subtitles. Music gatherings, a series of casual music gatherings at which students can play different types of instruments, and sports events and game nights.
Our regular events are member exclusive, and you will receive 25% discount on our annual events. You can visit us at ubcpc.com or email us through info@ubcpc.com.
Or you can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter.
So welcome back. Well, I was away. I was scanning this second article about the Perseids meteor shower. So they said you could see 50 or more meteors per hour on an optimum night. It's possible to see 150 meteors per hour. The meteors were supposed to be quick, bold, and white. So I hope if you saw it, you could see something very beautiful. It said here, after a meteor, watching the slender lunar crescent and the dazzling planet Venus will rise into the eastern sky at our night dawn. What a way to cap a night of meteor watching. So again, you can see why astronomy is just probably one of the best hobbies anybody could have, because it's so spectacular. So I'm going to go talk about Planet 9. So Planet 9 cousin has been found, apparently. And this is on LiveScience.com. The name of the article, of course, is Planet 9 Cousin Found. It's by Stephanie Pappas. It was 11 hours ago, so it was on Monday, then December the 14th. So it shows the artist's impression, shows the exoplanet called HD106906b, which orbits a double star about 336 light years away. So Planet 9 Cousin Found. Let's read on. An enormous exoplanet found circling a double star 336 light years away may provide clues to a mystery closer to home. In the far reaches of the solar system, out beyond Neptune, exists a cluster of icy celestial objects known as extreme trans-Neptunian Neptunian objects that move in an unexpected way. Some astronomers think these objects are responding to the gravitational pull of a yet unobserved planet known as Planet 9, which orbits very, very far away. Others think the weird objects are responding to the cumulative pull of some of other small object, not to one large planet. The new discovery of an exoplanet named HD 106906b could help explain how a planet could get kicked to the far edges of the solar system without being ejected altogether, according to researchers with the Hubble Space Telescope. So now the subtitle of this article is called Mysterious Object. The planet is 11 times the size of Jupiter, and was first discovered in 2013. However, until now, its orbit was a mystery. So this says this planet is 11 times the size of Jupiter. So I would guess from all that I've read before, it would have to be a gas giant, because I do believe there's a certain limit as to how big a rocky planet could get. And when I was reading before as well, what I remember was that Jupiter formed quite quickly in about 5,000 years, something like that. Anyway, it formed very quickly, and the Earth took like 5 to 10 million years to form. So apparently rocky planets take longer to form, and with gas giant, I believe because the way it happened in our solar system, it had to have formed early on, because it's possible the sun could have expanded, gotten bigger, sent out more light, and robbed the planet of material that it could accrete. So there's certain rules on how big certain things can be, like for example rocky planets. I think there's a rule in how big a rocky planet could be, and there's basically, I guess, I don't know if it's called rules, but astronomers talk about how planets form, like for example how a gas planet forms. There's certain things that could restrict how big a gas planet gets, and if it could form at all. I believe it, like Jupiter, had to form very on in the early solar system. So there's all these facts about how planets form, and I don't know them off by heart. So anyway, so this planet is 11 times the size of Jupiter and was first discovered in 2013. However, until now, its orbit was a mystery. That's because the exoplanet circles mind-bogglingly far away from the pair of stars at the center of the system, more than 730 times the distance between the Earth and the Sun. Because the gravitational pull of the stars is relatively weak at that distance, the planet orbits slowly, making a revolution once every 15,000 years. Now that's incredible. Measurements with the Hubble Space Telescope enabled researchers to characterize this snail-slow orbit. They discovered that the orbit is elongated and inclined at an odd angle. It's also outside a dusty disk of debris circling the star pair. So you wonder how, like, as we know from our first Star Wars movie, when Luke, towards the beginning of the movie, he looks at a sunset. I believe there's two stars that are setting. So how can a planet have a stable orbit in a multi-star system? Now, you'd have to have an expert to explain that, but you can see there's probably ways that a planet could be ejected from the system because of the two stars or three stars that are in the system. So anyway, so says study leader Meiji Guin, an astronomer at the University of California, Berkeley, and quote, To highlight why this is weird, we can just look at our own solar system and see that all of the planets arrive roughly in the same place. It would be bizarre if, say, Jupiter just happened to be inclined 30 degrees relative to the plane that every other planet orbits in. This raises all sorts of questions about how HD 106906b ended up so far out on such an inclined orbit. End quote. So I think we know that Pluto orbits at an incline. So I wonder if we met extraterrestrials from this planet and we said to them, welcome people, or whatever we'd call them, bugs or ants or whatever they were. Welcome, denizens of HD 106906b. And they'd say, how dare you call us HD1069B? So, anyway, I just thought maybe we're going to meet some of these aliens one day. So now here's a subsection. I know, I'll just keep talking. So here's a picture, an illustration of, not a picture, an illustration of Planet 9, a world about 10 times more massive than Earth that may lie undiscovered in the far outer solar system. So here it goes, a path to Planet 9. That's a sub-article or sub-heading, subtitle. Here's what scientists think may have happened. The exoplanet formed quite close to its star, even closer than Earth is to the Sun. Over time, though, drag caused the exoplanet's orbit to decay, which would have pulled it even closer to its host stars. Instead of colliding into them, though, the complex gravity of the pair of stars would have kicked the exoplanet into a new orbit, this one taking it far into space. Such an orbit could have sent the exoplanet beyond the gravitational reach of its host stars, kicking it out of the system altogether. But at the right moment, another star passed close to the alien system, stabilizing the exoplanet's orbit and preventing it from being ejected. Now, who would think of something like that? I don't know if that could happen, but anyway, that's what they say. Something similar may have happened in our own solar system, if Planet 9 exists. The hypothetical planet could have formed close to the Sun, only to be kicked towards the edge of the solar system by Jupiter's gravity. A passing star could have saved Planet 9 from being ejected altogether by pushing the planet away from Jupiter and toward the inner planets of the solar system. The Gaia project, an effort of the European Space Agency, is working to build a three-dimensional map of the galaxy over time that would help to identify such possible stellar interactions early in the solar system's history. So I can imagine this, the larger small Magellanic clouds. There is apparently a Magellanic stream where the Sun is, where our galaxy is ripping apart those Magellanic clouds and their stars are streaming into our galaxy. So it's possible we are guilty of sending a star close to some planet that would have it kicked out of its orbit. And when Andromeda merges with us in whatever 5 billion years, that could also happen. Some star could pass close to us and knock any planet with life out of its orbit. So these things do happen. But as I said, the scales that these happen on a long-term scale, something that our pitiful lives are about 80 years. So in astronomy, a million years is like a blink of an eye. So says study researcher Paul Callis of the University of California, Berkeley, and quote, "It's as if we had a time machine for our own solar system, going back 4.6 billion years, to see what may have happened when our young solar system was dynamically active and everything was being jostled around and rearranged," end quote. So who can tell what happened? There's hypotheses. You've heard me say that from information I got from shows from Brian Cox, I'll blame him, because if it's not true, I'll say, I didn't say it, Brian Cox said it. So there was, apparently, Mercury was around Mars's orbit, Jupiter moved in, Saturn moved in, then they both moved out. It's possible Planet 9 could have been in and out, and these other planetary systems, it said they could have been, their orbits could have changed. So now what I've seemed to be coming into my thick head is that planets do move. So when I really respect that scientists can look back into time and say, well, from this data, we think this happened, which is so cool, because who could ever come up with these hypotheses and theories as a people with a brain the size of Planet 9? And again, what I was really very impressed with when astronomers come up with their hypotheses and their models and their theories was when Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 finally left our solar system And when they got there, the scientists thought, well, this is what the heliosheath and the heliopause will look like. And when they get into interstellar space, this is what Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 will sample. And this will be the difference between what they sample in the solar system and when they get out of the solar system. And for the most part, these scientists were right. So imagine something that's, I believe, 14 billion miles away or something like that. And they say, we think that this is what is the reality of the situation out there. It has a heliosheath and heliopause and helio this, and they're right. And I'm just so impressed by what scientists can come up in their models and theories. But also, these same scientists are so aghast and flabbergasted and their jaws drop when spacecraft visit, for example, New Horizon visits Pluto, or when they get out into the Kuiper Belt, or when they Voyagers 1 and 2 went by Saturn and Jupiter and Neptune, and they're just awed by what they find. So, and again, as I said before, the Cassini system, or Cassini that went into the Saturnian system, into Saturn, they're still going to be analyzing data from that for 30, 40, 50 years from now. There's so much data to look at and analyze, and there's so many things that they will come up with. So, of course, some of these things awe the scientists, a lot of these discoveries, they can't believe that this is what the truth is out there. For example, Enceladus with its water geysers and Io with its volcanoes. And I still do think it's such an amazing thing that scientists can predict something like interstellar space, what interstellar space is going to be like when they haven't been there. So there's going to be a lot of things that we will still be awed by, for example, Cassini or any mission that goes out there. But anyway, this article was about Planet 9, where they're trying to find it. And I think there's a Planet 9 citizen science project that you could maybe join with NASA. So I'm going to go for a break now. When I come back, we're going to talk more astronomy. This is Marco. You're listening to Astro Talk on CITR 101.9.
CITR 101.9 FM and Discorder Magazine are celebrating Asian heritage by telling notable stories of Asian Canadians.
Ujjal Dosanjh was born in Jalandhar, India in 1947 and moved to Vancouver at the age of 17. He learned English by editing a Punjabi newspaper, eventually earning a law degree at UBC. After practicing family and personal injury law in private practice, he was elected as MLA to Vancouver Kensington in 1991. From there, he became Attorney General in 1997 and Canada's first South Asian Premier in February of 2000.
For more information about how to celebrate Asian heritage in Vancouver, visit exploration.org.
Do you hear what I'm hearing?
Come enjoy British Columbia's beautiful wilderness with the UBC Varsity Outdoors Club. Try your hand at hiking, backcountry skiing, rock climbing, kayaking, and much more. Whether you're a beginner or an expert, we have trips happening every week, usually at no cost.
Living my dream.
Check us out online at ubc-voc.com.
Welcome back. This is Marco. You're listening to Astro Talk on 101.9. There was a show, again, I watch BBC Earth a lot, and there was a show about the ice giants. And they were talking about Triton and the moon of Neptune and how the theory was it spins opposite to what the way planets rotates. So the scientists are saying, well, then it's a captured object from the Kuiper Belt, and it could be something like another Pluto or something that wandered in and was nudged out of the Kuiper Belt by something or something. And then it got captured by Neptune. So this is something I'm looking at. It says the 12 weirdest things, the 10 interesting places in the solar system we'd like to visit. So one of the places are, Triton and Proteus. So Triton is the largest of Blue and Neptune's moons and the only round one. The moon is high on the list of reasons of researchers' places to send a spacecraft because it sports so many strange qualities. Triton is on a retrograde orbit, revolving in the opposite direction of the planet and other moons, suggesting it could have been captured. Captured Pluto-like body. From its surface rise bizarre ice volcanoes, making it one of the farthest bodies in the solar system known to have active geophysics. Triton's sibling, Neptune's second largest moon, Proteus, is also pretty unusual. Rather than being round, this moon is shaped like what mathematicians call an irregular polyhedron, a solid object with many plane faces, and what Dungeons and Dragons nerds known as a 20-sided dice. Proteus's surface is pinkish red, perhaps the result of complex organic compounds like hydrocarbons. Okay, so let's look at one more thing in this thing of the 10 most interesting places we like to visit in the solar system. One of them are Ida and Dactyl. In 1993, the Galileo spacecraft was en route to Jupiter. Along the way, it stopped to photograph an unusual object, the asteroid Ida, which became only the second asteroid ever to be visited by a probe. Ida contained a tiny surprise for scientists, an itty-bitty moon named Dactyl, the first satellite discovered orbiting an asteroid. Both objects are a bit strange in that they experience space weathering from the sun that causes their surfaces to turn red over time. Scientists are still scratching their heads over how old Ida is and how it got this little moon. Okay, so there's lots of... Let's look at one more of these things, a place we'd like to visit in our solar system. It's called Miranda's Gnarly Cliffs. Remember, gnarly. The ice giant Uranus's moon Miranda is a spelunker's dream. Its jagged surface is replete with canyons, scarps, terraced outcrops, and a cliff whose floor is approximately 12.4 miles or 20 kilometers down, the highest known cliff in the solar system. Mm-hmm. Miranda's geological scars could be due to flowing ice from the moon's interior that at some point were pushed up to the surface. So let's read that again. Miranda's geological scars could be due to flowing ice from the moon's interior that at some point were pushed up to the surface. An even wilder theory proposes that the moon was shattered several times and came back together, creating its extremely uneven features. Okay, so let's go on to the next article about, guess what? It's about astronomy. So I've already read that. The Gemini Shower is going to close that. And the next article is called How to Watch the Northern Lights from the Far Northern U.S. But that was last night. So I'm going to read one more article. Oh, I looked at this. It's the Drake Equation. So is this spying? China might say it. But what happened now? A NASA spacecraft spot China's Chang'e 5 lander on the moon. Before I go on to this article, it's so amazing how all these NASA spacecraft and ESA, European Space Agency, and I'd say China and Japan as well, they have their spacecraft that go out into space and perform certain functions. So I guess the Hayabashi missions from Japan, where they went to a certain asteroid or meteor and retrieve samples from it, and China's Chang'e lander is on the moon. When are humans going to go back into space? That's the best part of it. When will humans fly to the moon or go to Mars and stuff? That's what I think I'm looking for, and maybe a lot of other people are looking for or waiting for. But anyway, here, NASA spacecraft spot China's Chang'e 5 lander on the moon. So is that spying? Okay, here's a photo. It's an actual photo. The Chang'e 5 lander, imaged by NASA's LOR on December 2nd, 2020. It shows that, wow, image from NASA, Arizona State University. Maybe China doesn't like that. NASA's Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, or LRO, captured an image of China's Chang'e 5 lander on the moon just hours after its historic landing. So China's not lying, because the USA got a picture of it. The Chang'e 5 lander set down on the lunar surface last Tuesday, December 1st. The reason I said that, it popped in my mind, there was when Trump lost his last, that Texas lawsuit against other states, the 128 House of Representative members and 18 attorney generals from different states signed on to the lawsuit. So after it failed, they got one of the senators on CNN, or one of the House members on CNN, and they go, well, Joe Biden won the election. And the Senate, and the House member said, well, I don't know that. I don't know that men landed on the moon. How can you prove it? So he brought that up, like, how can you know that men landed on the moon? So that's one of the conspiracy theories. And he's floating conspiracy theories. And, you know, if you think about it, we accept all these things. So we think that men landed on the moon. But this House representative says, well, how do I know men landed on the moon or not? So that's why I brought it up, because it was related to astronomy. But anyway, let's go on. The Chang'e 5 lander set down on the lunar surface last Tuesday, December 1st. Thanks to China's prompt release of the stunning Chang'e 5's landing video, the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter Camera, LROC team, were able to locate the roughly 4-ton spacecraft in Oceanus Procellarum, the Ocean of Storms, and prepare for when LRO would pass overhead the next day. So I can imagine sometime in the future when, I guess, the Artemis program, within 5 years, I think President Trump said there's going to be men and women going back and forth from the moon from a space base that's floating around the moon. So I hope that happens. But could there be a, China could say, well, why do you, U.S., seem to have the right, where you think you have the right to claim the space and claim this land on the moon, where you could just land on and say, well, this is ours. So there could be a lot of things that happen in the future that could be political in terms of astronomy. The image shows Chang'e's lander in the center of three craters. Automated systems had helped the spacecraft to avoid these hazards to land safely. So again, this article called NASA Spacecraft Spots China's Chang'e 5 Lander on the Moon by Andrew Jones 5 days ago, which is right now I'm talking. It is December 14th, so that was December 9th. That's when this article came out. And the reason I'm bringing this up is there's a nice video here called China Chang'e's 5 Moon Journey. If you play it, then it can show the actual spacecraft. It looks so cool. I remember when I was in Beijing last time. I did live in Beijing about 2007 to 2008, so I lived there for 1 year. But when I went back to visit a year and a half ago or so, a year ago, I went to their National Museum, and it showed their space program, and a lot of Chinese were very proud of it. Of course they were. So back to the article. The relatively flat area near the Chang'e 5 lander was created by basaltic lavas. While over a billion years old, this unit of basalt is thought to be much younger than the Apollo landing areas, which are aged at over 3 billion years. Much younger. So the Apollo landing areas were, they thought, where they landed, it was 3 billion years old, the soil, and this was about a billion years ago. Samples are therefore of great interest to scientists who want to know why this region was volcanically active much more recently than most other places on the moon. The image was taken before the Chang'e 5 ascent vehicle blasted off from the surface with the collected samples. The ascent vehicle has since performed a spectacular rendezvous and docking with the Chang'e 5 orbiter and handed over the sample. Chang'e 5 will begin its journey to Earth later this week. So I'm wondering if China will share some of the Earth samples with other countries. Well, we'll see. But so far, I do believe that Russia and the U.S. have a lot of cooperation in terms of space. And so especially you would think that the European Space Agency and NASA cooperate on so many things, share data. And of course, Canada is part of that team. The Chang'e 5 sample return mission is expected to last just 23 days, ending with a landing in Inner Mongolia around December 17th. LRO, meanwhile, has been mapping the moon in high definition for more than 11 years, while also hunting for signs of water. So this was, I think, something that's going to be so exciting within hopefully 5 years, if men and then a woman lands on the moon, and then they have that space station orbiting the moon where astronauts can live on the space station and then just jettison down to the moon and go back up to the space station later. And of course you're thinking about, well, a habitat is on the moon. What if they put actual habitat where people are living on the moon and getting by on the moon? And that would just be so exciting. So to me, this is just like a dream come true with all these futuristic things happening basically around the corner. So thank you for listening. This was Marco. Think about the Drake equation. Think about how you can modify or formulate a new Drake equation because you become famous. Thank you for listening. This has been Marco. You have listened to Astro Talk on CITR 101.9.